History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And of course, we've discovered they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions. And then to invest a little time patiently listening as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every week, I know some of you are hearing this program for the very first time, especially when we welcome a new radio affiliate. And we get to do that this weekend with Truth 104, the Tri-Cities Voice of Truth, reaching Bristol, Kingsport, and Johnson City, Tennessee, from that home base in Southwest Virginia. And that's not to be confused with the other Tri-Cities in Washington, where maybe you're listening right now on KONA. Wherever you're listening, you can find nearly 800 previous episodes online at hometownheroesradio.com. And the 100-year-old Marine we get to meet today lives in Oceano, California, a stone's throw from the Pacific Ocean, where our longtime affiliates KVEC in San Luis Obispo and KSMA in Santa Maria reach Hometown Heroes listeners every weekend. Most of the veterans we meet on this show get introduced to us by listeners like you. And when more than one of you suggests the very same veteran, it's a pretty good clue to me that I better pay attention. So before I forget, I want to thank a couple of listeners out there on California's Central Coast. Linda and Candy, they both let me know about 100-year-old Jesse Arney. So thank you, ladies. In fact, Candy and her husband Phil got to cheer on Mr. Arney this past February for his 100th birthday when a great local group there called Welcome Home Military Heroes provided a special birthday parade in front of the home that Jess and his wife of 75 years, Lola, have shared there in Oceano for over four decades. Hopefully we'll get to hear from Lola a bit before we're done, too, if Jess lets her get a word in edgewise. You can find photos and a short video of this spirited couple at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're going to hear about how this Purple Heart recipient survived three major battles in the Pacific with Company B of the 3rd Tank Battalion, 3rd Marine Division during World War II. But we always like to take you all the way back to the beginning.
I was born in Maud, Oklahoma, 1923, and I grew up 8 years there, and then we moved to Shafter, lived there for 50 years. Then we moved over here, and we lived there for 40 years.
So where are you heading to next?
Up. Heaven. I'm going to heaven. I'm going there when I die.
I heard you like to sing. Well, so obviously you're a child of the Dust Bowl, and so many came from Oklahoma to California during that period.
We came from Oklahoma out here in 1932, which is when everybody was leaving Oklahoma.
Do you remember anything about those early childhood years in Oklahoma before you left?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, but I can't tell them. I was a little bitty fella, but I was fast. And the bigger kids would go off into the woods and play dare or double dare. And me being little and sneaky, I'd follow them and watch them. You'd be surprised what they dared to do in there. Anyway, that's another story that can't be told.
Well, that part I understand. Do you remember having some big ideas when you were a youngster of, hey, when I grow up, here's who I'm going to be or this is what I'm going to do?
I didn't have no ideas. I knew I was going to be something, but I wasn't worried about what I was going to be.
And, you know, most of us alive today didn't live through the Great Depression. Do you remember what things were like? Can you give us some perspective on that?
Well, I was young. I think I was around 8 or something like that. And we didn't have nothing. We was poor as church mice. But my dad was a professional gambler after that. And after he started that, we had plenty. But, yeah.
I know a lot of farmers who tell me they're professional gamblers. Are you talking about that, or he really was a professional gambler?
It's the way he made his living, with cards. And he was a good gambler, I guess, because we didn't have nothing before he started that. And then we had stuff good after that.
And I've interviewed quite a few World War II veterans who grew up in Oklahoma and came west, and a lot of them have some stories that put a picture in our mind of what that looked like when they came out. And it sometimes it kind of sounds like the Beverly Hillbillies, but sometimes not. What was your experience when you were coming this way?
Well, I'll tell you what. There was my uncle had this old Chevy, and he made it into like a camper, you know. And it had on each side a 1x12 on each side of it, and you could lay up there. But we all, it was my mother and dad and me and my two older sisters. And then I had a younger brother and a younger sister that came out with us. After that, we got more. But anyway, there was all that in one little car. But didn't we have, we pulled a two-wheel trailer, and we had it loaded with two mattresses on top. Typical Okie stuff, you know. Two mattresses on top. And my dad, he was my really stepdad, but he was my dad. We never called him stepdad or nothing. He was just our father. He was a good one, one of the best. And anyway, so we had this two-wheel trailer,
yeah.
And it was loaded, and it was just kind of overloaded, actually, I guess. And my dad and one of my aunt's brothers rode on top of that trailer, and then the car was full of people, and five of them, I think, was kids.
So they rode all the way from Oklahoma to California on top of the mattress on top of the trailer?
Yeah. Yes, they did. But we were poor people. But we had two mattresses.
What were they holding on to?
Well, the mattresses tied down. You know, there was ropes. Oh, we had a ball, I guess. I was only eight.
What was it like once you got to Shafter, California? What was life like there?
You see, we was different than most people. That they called them Okies. Most Okies, because we had a kinfolks that already lived out here. My grandmother and my grandfather and my uncle and aunt. And then the one that we come out here with, they already lived out here, and they come back to Oklahoma, and we come back to California with them. And that was in 1932. Anyway, we come out here, and we someplace in Arizona had a breakdown. Something about the axle slipped out of the trailer. So we had to send to my grandfather and mother's grandmother to get some money to fix the trailer. I was only eight, and then I had two older sisters, and then I had a brother under me was five, and then I had a sister under him.
So you had to camp out on the side of the road till the money came to fix it, or what?
Oh, yeah, we're good campers.
I know a little bit about your story in the Marine Corps, and I'm just trying to think in my head, which one was more impressive that you survived, that trip from Oklahoma to California at age eight, or what you went through in the Pacific?
Oh, no comparison there.
So you get to California, and did you go to Shafter High School?
Yeah, when we first came out here, we went to what you call Maple School, which was a little bitty country school, and I was in the second grade. And then I went to second and third there, and then we moved to another place, and I went to a little old country school, and there was 30 kids most of the time. I had one class, and they taught woodwork, and they taught cooking. I learned how to saw boards and nail boards and all that sort of good stuff that I can still do.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I saw the beautiful red, white, and blue lighthouse out front when I walked in, and was going to ask if you're still working with wood all these years later.
Not now. I built four or five lighthouses, and maybe six, I don't know, something like that. Then I built wishing wells. I built windmills. I built this. Put an extension on the bar over there.
So there in Shafter, as you're in your high school years, did you have any idea that a war was coming?
No. I didn't worry about stuff like that. I was just being ornery.
So I'm doing the math. Pearl Harbor happened when you were 18. Were you already done with high school?
I quit. I got smarter than the teachers when I was in the 10th grade.
Uh-huh.
After the 10th grade, I quit because I told them, I said, I'm smarter than you guys, so I'm quitting. So I quit and fiddled around and got into lots of mischief, you know. We run out of tires. I had this old 34 Chevy, and we run out of tires. So we was running on two wheels, two tires, and two rims. And I said, this ain't going to work. So we stole a trailer, two-wheel trailer, hauled it out in the country. And we was going to take the wheels off, but we couldn't get the wheels off, so we just left it out there. Finally, the police chased us down. And by that time, though, I'd already went to the Marines. So they got my brother and our friend, and they made them go and get that trailer and take it back and apologize. But they said, we know your brother was in with you. Said, but we're gonna let him get by with it.
Well, speaking of the Marines, I know you joined after Pearl Harbor.
I'll tell you how I got in the Marines. This leads right up to it right now. Yeah, and so I says to my friend, I says, we can't do this. Said, we got to do something. What are we going to do? And we said, we could join the service. He said, what branch? I said, well, the Marines. They got the prettiest uniform, so they'll get the prettiest girls. And sure enough, I got the prettiest girl. And we went to boot camp. Then from boot camp, we went to Camp Elliott and stayed a while. And they put me into driving into the motor pool to drive a truck. So I got in the truck, and I went and stayed going all day in the truck. So when I got back, they didn't like that at all. So they took me out of the motor pool, and they put me into the light artillery. So they called for an inspection, which as I disobeyed orders. I didn't fall out for inspection. So they put me into the mess hall. I did my little deal in the mess hall. So then when I got out, they put me in heavy artillery. So they called inspection. I damn nothing. So I didn't fall out for inspection. So they put me back in the mess hall. I kind of like that duty. So anyway, after that, let's see. Then they put me in the infantry, and they put me to carrying sea bags. You know what a sea bag is. Okay, I carried them from way over yonder, me and two or three other guys, way over to another storage. I don't know why, but they were heavy. So I decided, well, I don't like this. I don't want the infantry. I says, I want to get someplace where it's going to take something bigger than a rifle to get me. Because I said, I don't want to be shot while I'm just standing around outside. I said, I want to get in something that'll protect me. So they asked if anybody had ever drove a Caterpillar. I said, yeah, me. And I had before I went in the Marines. So they said, okay, you're going in the tank company. I said, okay. So they were there, and they took us out on the firing range. So the guy that took us was our instructor. His name was Murphy, tall, slim guy from Tennessee or something like that, or Tennessee or Kentucky, one of those places like that. And he took us, and he said, we're going to shoot at this target, and it's going to be a moving target. So he started to pull in across there, and I missed it, shot behind it. And he said, take a little lead. So I took a little lead on it, and the next nine shots, I put them all in there. So he said, you're going to be a gunner. So then I was his gunner for a while, and then he got promoted or something. And finally I got to be the, in Bougainville we had light tanks, but we couldn't do anything because Bougainville is mostly swamps. And they had coconut log roads, and we'd slip off into the boonies, into the marsh. But anyway, then they got the medium tanks. We went through Bougainville, and then we went through Guam, and we took Guam, which Guam belonged to us before.
And I'd love to hear more about that, because obviously you've never been in combat before. How did you adjust to this new reality you were living in?
That didn't bother me. I just take it as it goes. I didn't like authority. I didn't like it for people giving me orders. But anyway.
Did you experience some close calls in those battles that stand out in your memory?
Well, we were on Guam, and so we started to cross this little dirt road, and we got the front end out on it, and bam, 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 three shots. But this guy wasn't very smart. He hit the track, and he shot the track into. But our driver just put it in reverse and backed up. And while he was backing up, I was blasting that tank. He was camouflaged, but and my tank commander later, he said, boy, he said, you blowed the tar out of that tank. And anyway, we got called a retriever up, and they put us on fixed our track for us, and we went on about our business. And okay, well, so we took Guam, and then we made that our home base. And then from Guam, we went to Iwo Jima.
And before I hear about Iwo Jima, maybe you can give me a sense for how these tanks would operate, how many people you had in that crew, and what your role was.
Well, you know, the first, on Bougainville, we had light tanks. They had a 37 millimeter cannon and a machine gun. Okay, that was on Bougainville, and I was a gunner. And then we went from Bougainville, after we got Bougainville, went to Guam. But we got medium tanks before we went to Guam. So we went and took over Guam, and I was a gunner and a tank, and we had medium tanks, Shermans. So we kept those, and then we left from Guam. We went to Iwo Jima.
And when you say you're a gunner, can you give us a picture of where that means you would be in the tank?
That means that I was up on the turret where the tanks goes around, you know, the gun goes around, and I was operating that. And I had a machine gun, and I had a cannon. And then we had a loader, and then we had a tank commander. And then this was on the Shermans. And then we had a driver, and we had a assistant driver. And the assistant driver had a machine gun. So anyway, we from Guam, we stayed Guam. That was our home base. And so we was loading up ammunition. We was going to have another campaign. We didn't know where. We was loading up ammunition, and the general come around and was talking to us. And he said something about ammunition. I said, yeah, but they won't let us fill up. I said, they're only giving us just a partial load. I said, we need the full load. And so he said, you guys go ahead and fill that thing up. Says, I'll make it all right. So we took a full load of shells, and then we come. Then we went to Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima, where American forces would suffer more than 27,000 casualties. More than 6,000 Marines lost their lives in a five-week battle for that small volcanic outpost. And Jesse Arney came awfully close to adding to that number. In fact, he was essentially left for dead inside his tank. We'll hear that chapter of his story from this 100-year-old World War II veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 100-year-old Jesse Arney of Oceano, California. Originally from Maud, Oklahoma, in February of 1945, he would end up spending his 22nd birthday on a hospital ship because of what happened to him on Iwo Jima. By this point, Arney had already made it through the battles of Bougainville and Guam as a tank gunner with Company B, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marine Division.
We took Iwo Jima, but while we was doing that, we didn't run over it, we ran on it, and it blew us up on the left side.
Well, and I want to hear about that, because that, I know that's certainly an unforgettable day in your life, but there was a lot of that battle that kind of led up to that, and Iwo Jima is one of those battles that people still argue over today. Some people say, did we really need to take that island and cost all those American lives? And then the others say, well, yeah, we needed those airstrips so the B-29s had somewhere to land. As far as what you experienced, can you remember coming ashore there, what you were seeing, what it felt like?
Seeing bodies all over the place, because the infantry, they cut them down whenever they hit, you know. You've seen them in the movies go out of the front of the boat when go up there and let the ramp down, and away they went. Well, our tank was on one of those bigger ones. Mm-hmm. And so they just threw us the same way, but there was bodies all over the place. Mm. You had to be careful where you drove. But anyway, Yeah, we took Iwo Jima. Oh, Lordy mercy.
Well, and you mentioned it's a volcanic island, and, you know, I've talked to some of the guys who took the LCVPs in there to land troops, and they talked about how it was so hard to get the boats on that volcanic sand with the tides. And what about your tanks? How did they handle that sandy soil?
Well, you had to be real careful, because if you turn too sharp, that you'd put that, work that sand up and under the tracks, and it'd get stretch out, too tight, and bust to break the track. So we'd go straight out. They went straight out after we got the tank out, and went straight out till we get up far. We could kind of make a slow turn.
This may seem like a silly question, but I think it probably gives us some perspective. What were your sleeping arrangements on Iwo Jima?
On Iwo Jima, I slept mostly in the tank. So I, you know, you could dig down in about 10 inches and put your can beans and stuff like that down in there, and it'd heat it for you. But anyway, to sleep out, I slept under the tank a lot of times, and that's what, you know, could get away from it, because the heat in the tank. So I may be jumping a little ahead, but on Guam, they had a banzai attack. You know what a banzai attack is. Well, we had our tanks all lined up there, you know, and I had been sleeping under the tank because it was hot. So two infantry guys come up and ask if they could sleep under our tank. So I said, oh, sure, I'll sleep inside. So they did. Well, the next morning they was dead. They had that banzai attack, and they went through there, and some of them got through, and they killed those two guys. If they hadn't tucked that, I'd have been under there. So the Lord, he works in mysterious ways. Yeah.
So the Japanese came in the night.
Well, they come, they made a run, you know. It's like, you see in the movie, where just like a wave of coming, and that's just the way they was doing. Wave after wave. And we just couldn't cut them down fast enough. Not lots of them. So what they did, they got killed. Yeah, that was Guam.
Well, and, you know, that makes me wonder how, because you're a young man. I mean, at this point, that's 1944. So you're 21 years old, and here these guys died, and you know it could have been you. How do you process that in your mind?
I don't. I just think the good Lord didn't want me to go. I think the Lord allows us so much time, but he can shorten it or he can lengthen it out. And I think he decided to let me go a little longer. How else would I get to be 100?
That's right. Did you get desensitized to the guys around you being wounded or killed?
It bothered you, but you couldn't let it stop you. You just had to keep on doing your thing, because everybody depended on everybody. And I was one of the best gunners that they had. And there's another one, and another outfit was pretty, he was good too, but we were the best gunners they had. I usually hit what I shot at.
But they're shooting at you, too.
Oh, yeah, but that's all right.
And, you know, we're talking about Iwo Jima, and you say the words Iwo Jima, and the first thing that comes to people's mind is that flag going up atop Mount Suribachi. I've talked to a lot of guys who say they saw, there were two flags, first flag and second flag, but I've talked to a lot of guys who say they saw one or the other. Do you remember seeing that?
I was aboard the hospital ship. Yeah, if I remember right, I was aboard the hospital ship. They put that up on my birthday, February the 23rd. I was aboard a hospital ship, and when our tank got blown up, it killed the driver.
Let me back you up there a little bit. I know you ran over a landmine, but tell me what you guys were doing that day, what led up to that moment, and maybe walk me through that entire sequence.
Well, we was moving up to the front, getting up in the front, and we was making a charge. We was getting ready to cross the airstrip. Well, they'd planted that, whatever it was, and we hit it, run up on it. So the gunner, the loader, and the tank commander got out of the tank, and the driver was dead. The assistant driver was in bad, bad shape, and I was out cold and had a gash on my chin. And they left. They didn't even check to see if I was dead.
So, sorry for all the questions. I'm trying to get the picture in my mind. So you guys, you're crawling along in this tank, trying to move up to the front, and you're riding in the turret?
Yes, but it's closed.
So the turret's closed, but you're up near the top?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did you feel the explosion?
Yeah, and I got knocked out. To see the guys down below, they are more dangerous or something like that than we are, because we're all kind of above that. When it did that, I got this, I guess, from being locked around in the turret. And I had my leather tank helmet on, but I don't know what happened. It wasn't on. And I got this big cache here. And so these two guys got out and didn't even check to see if I was dead or not. I was just out. Yeah, he didn't like me anyway, and I didn't like him. The tank commander was second lieutenant.
So this explosive device that you hit, did it flip the tank over?
No.
So it exploded and just...
It hit the front part of it, uh-huh. Hit right over where the driver was sitting. Well, you could hear, you could feel it, but it didn't turn it over or nothing like that. Mm-hmm. But it did blow a track off, and it did kill a guy. But us guys up in the turret, we didn't have to worry about that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. because we had to worry about the people shooting us with a big gun.
So the tank commander and the loader get out. The driver's killed, the assistant driver's wounded, and you've got a gash in your chin from getting rattled around, but you're unconscious. So when you finally came to, where were you? What were you seeing? What were you hearing?
When I came to, I didn't take no stock of anything except that I was by myself in there. And so I just got out, and I went right out the top and dropped down beside those two tank commanders and the loader. I dropped down right beside them. And another tank come up behind us, and they dropped their escape hatch, and we slid in under the tank and got in it, and they took us back to the first aid station. Then I went aboard the hospital ship till I got tired of it, and they lobbed a big old shell over the bow of the ship, and I said to myself, I said, you can't swim 3 miles. So you better. So I told myself I want to go back to my outfit. So they did. They sent me back. And you know, I don't remember going back, but I know I did. And then when I got ashore, I don't remember getting back to my outfit, but I did. And so my tank commander, he said, they put your tank, that's your gun on top of that tank. Said, you got to man it. Well, he was a tank commander, but he didn't man it. He didn't get in it. But anyway, I said, okay, what you can say. And so I got in that, and we was going along there, and tanks are so big, they just run over stuff. So I seen this box sitting out there. It must have been about 12 by 12, 12 by 11, anyway, a little square box about so big. And I thought, so I shot it. It blowed a hole, and that's about almost big enough to hide that tank in it. Yeah. And our driver was headed right for it.
So if you hadn't seen it and shot it, it might have killed all of you.
It would have tore us up, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I know we're bouncing around, but let's go back to the day you got wounded. So when you drop down and find the other two guys who had gotten out of the tank, were they surprised to see you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, the matter, my loader, the first reunion we went to together, he apologized for leaving me in there. But he, the tank commander, and I, we didn't like each other. In fact, about it, I threatened to kill him. So anyway, he didn't care whether I was dead or not.
And what was the extent of your injuries?
Cut on the chin. I guess it's where it bounced me around and knocked my helmet off and hit me head, hit my chin someplace. I was kind of bleeding throughout when I got out of the tank. And we went and they took us back to the aid station, and then they took back to the hospital ship.
So on the hospital ship, you were able to see that flag atop Mount Suribachi, or did you just hear about it?
I seen it later. I don't remember just when I seen it, but it's on my birthday. I know that's what they tell me anyway. And so I decided to go back to shore.
When you see that picture now of the Marines raising the flag on top of Mount Suribachi, what kind of thoughts or memories does it bring up for you?
I just don't No, it doesn't bother me.
So you got back to your unit. You saved the tank by blowing up that explosive on the road at that point. And were you there on Iwo Jima till the island was secure?
Yes. While we was going along, I was shooting over the little knoll with my big cannon. With my cannon, I just elevated and shoot over it. I don't know what was on the other side, but I know it's the enemy. I didn't wait for no tank commander to tell me what to do. If I seen something, I just done it. Because sometimes they're not as smart as they think they are.
Well, that island was finally secured, but it came at a very heavy cost. Did you ever visit the cemetery on Iwo Jima?
No. After I got off of the ship and we finished Iwo Jima, and then we went back to Guam. So they was taking the people that was wounded back to San Diego. And so my friends told me, my buddies said, you'll probably go in the first round. Not so, my tank commander, he didn't send me. That's what I get for being smarty. And anyway, I stayed there, and finally, I was down to about the last group that went, but I did finally go, and they took us back to San Diego. Yeah, from San Diego. And then I ended up at Treasure Island, and I stayed there about a year and a half. Guard duty on the gate. Yeah, Marines always have guards. They have guard duties. Oh, they got to have guards. But that was good duty on the Treasure Island, because I was corporal of the guard, and I didn't have nothing to do except just go around and check on the guards.
It's time for our final break, but we'll get another war memory or two out of 100-year-old Jesse Arney when we come back. I'm also hoping to hear about his trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Central Coast, California. And we definitely need to hear the story of how he met his wife of 75 years, Lola. You can find photos and a brief video with these two lovebirds at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes feed on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful. And I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 100-year-old Purple Heart Marine Jesse Arney of Oceano, California. We heard about his childhood in Oklahoma and his family's challenging escape from the Dust Bowl during the Great Depression. We heard some Marine Corps memories from the battles of Bougainville, Guam, and finally Iwo Jima, where a mine explosion under his tank rendered him unconscious and, briefly, left for dead. He spent the last 4 decades on California's Central Coast, where evidence of his woodworking skill is all over and around the home he shares with his wife of 75 years, Lola. But the story of how these two met in Shafter, California, after World War II, well, it's one of those I feel like I maybe should put a little disclaimer in front of. The old, don't try this at home. Or at least if you're a young man out there listening today, do not try this with one of my 2 teenage daughters. But we wouldn't want to hear anything but the true story, right? So let's hear how it really happened from Jesse and hopefully Lola, too.
Well, I guess I was on the weekend or something, I forget. Anyway, I was home for the weekend for a furlough or something, and she was the car hop at one of the little drive-ins there. She's only 14, and I was 22. Oh, she was young and innocent. And so a friend of mine, we was there at the deal, car hop, and she worked there. So he introduced me to her. Well, I just planted a big kiss on her.
You know, these days you can get arrested for that.
And you could then, too. But she loved me so much right now. I just, ooh.
What did you think that first time you met him when you're just trying to do your job and he comes and kisses you?
Well, I didn't appreciate it. I didn't appreciate it at all. I didn't appreciate it. You knew I didn't appreciate it. He just thought I did.
Oh, now, baby doll.
No, I didn't.
How did he finally win you over? How long did it take?
Oh, mercy. Over a year. I was 14.
So, you know, a lot of people would say that a Marine kissing a 14-year-old is a real bad idea, and that a 16-year-old getting married to a 24-year-old is a really bad idea. But here you are, 75 years later, you're still married. So how did you make this whole thing work here? What's the secret?
We're just so good together. She spoiled me. Now, we love each other, you know. Just because she was young don't mean nothing. Oh, her mother thought I was wonderful. She said, oh, I'm going to get rid of my last daughter.
What was it about Lola that was so captivating for you that you knew this is the one?
Oh, I don't know, but she's just pretty. She's pretty. She's beautiful. She's lovely. And besides that, she's had a good kiss.
Of self-defense.
I'm the only one that could win her.
Because there's a lot of people that listen to this and would want to know, you know, how they can make their marriage last, like your marriage has lasted 75 years. So what do you think has made the difference for you?
I guess I pleased him. I guess. I don't know what he thought about me.
Well, we do know he thought you were pretty special, and clearly you would have appreciated him expressing that in a very different fashion. But what's this story about your wedding? I'm not trying to cause more trouble here. Sometimes it's hard to tell when you two are kidding around and when you're not. But there was even a little confusion when you got married?
I meant it for men on. I meant I do.
So he said, I do, but they didn't ask you?
No, the judge just looked at me and he said, well, do you? And I didn't say I do. I didn't.
So it sounds like you just got roped into this whole deal.
I did. No. No, I finally knew what was going on. He taught me everything I know.
I can tell you like needling each other, but you must think he's all right by now after 75 years, huh?
I wouldn't trade him for a step back up. I just love him. I'd do anything for him. Anything.
I think the old song is, for every man there's a woman. Mm-hmm. I think everybody has got a mate if they could just find them. But some people go through life and never find the right one, I think. But we found the right ones at the first time. And when I said I do, that meant her is the only one.
As far as I'm concerned, our son, before he was even thinking about getting married, he said, Mom, don't you ever want to go out with didn't you want to go out with another fella? And I said, no, Jerry. after I met your dad, I said I knew he was the one. And he thought maybe, you know, I'd want to go. I couldn't even think about being with another person.
You know, I know we've bounced around a lot. When you think back to all that time you spent in the Marine Corps, and I know they say once a Marine, always a Marine. But when you think back on those experiences, day after day after day, is there something you look back on as being the most challenging or the hardest part of all of that?
Well, you know, I think I was kind of smart. I said, I don't want to be standing around and a little old rifle give me. I said, well, if I get hit, I want to get hit with something big enough to do me some harm. So I joined the door, got the tank. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, we got a big enough something to get us.
Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington?
I've been on the honor flight, and me and Jerry went on. Yeah, he went as my guardian.
What was that experience like for you?
Oh, that was beautiful. That was really, really good. They really showed us respect every place we went. They picked us up in San Luis Obispo, and they flew us to Maryland.
So I want to ask you about a couple things you got to see on that honor flight. You got to go to the Marine Corps Memorial, where they have that giant statue of the Marines putting the flag up at Mount Suribachi.
Beautiful. That was really good. They took up pictures with everybody. And the kids, I'm telling you, young kids was there, and they was just stand by and shake your hand as you went by and thank you. Oh, it was really nice. Jerry was pushing me around in a wheelchair. He's watching the big Canadian geese. Oh, big old geese. He was watching them, and he almost dumped me. There was a little spot in the walk we was on, and it just kind of broke on one side, and he hit that, and I started to go, and he grabbed me.
So you got to see that Marine Corps Memorial, and they also took you to the National World War II Memorial, where they have a wall of gold stars. And that's representing 400,000 Americans who didn't come home. Was there any part of you that looked at that wall of gold stars and said, I could have been one of those?
Yeah, weren't my time.
You served with some of the guys that those gold stars represent. There was a guy in your tank the day you got wounded who didn't come home.
Yeah, that was a guy from Louisiana. His name was Jim Thornhill. And he left home and joined the Marine Corps because his dad married this kid's high school teacher, and she was only 2 years older than him. And he says, I had to leave home. And he got killed.
And every one of those 406,000 had a name, had a story like that. And you saw Jim in the prime of his life, and then he was killed the day you got wounded. How should we remember those who made that ultimate sacrifice?
Just remember, they're just like any other people. They just sit at the wrong place at the wrong time.
And we hear a lot about, you know, the price of freedom. Like I say, with Iwo Jima, some people say, was it worth it? Did we really need it? What's your perspective on all of that?
Well, we needed it for airstrip. Because, you know, you had to have a place for airplanes to land, so we had to have it. Because they'd come in on a wing and a prayer. Yeah, they're awful.
And you mentioned that name, Jim Thornhill. Were there others that you knew well who didn't come home from the war?
Well, you know, I don't remember the others, but he was in my tank, so yeah. But there was others, because there was more tanks blowed up than mine. But after I got blowed, we got blowed up, and I went aboard a hospital ship, then I lost track of anybody else that was hit. But I know that there's other drivers and assistant drivers that was killed. I know one of our tanks got 9 hits, and on one of the hits, they went through 9 inches, 8 or 9 inches of armor plating, and it just pierced the inside, but then fell back out. And the tank was hit 9 times. And that guy's, Birdsell was his name. He was a gunner. He is a good one. I don't know, you know, there was other ones killed because we lost 4 or 5 tanks in a matter of 4 or 5 minutes in our companies, because they planted them things all over the place. And boy, they wasn't small ones either. They was big ones.
You know, you're one of the last guys who can tell us a story like this.
I guess maybe that's why I'm here.
Well, and, you know, most of us alive today didn't live through that time period, so we can't remember what it was like. The only way we can understand is from people like you sharing the stories. So what is important, do you think, for us to understand about World War II and what you all did? Why does it still matter today?
Well, you know, you remember the old song, Remember Pearl Harbor, as you did the Alamo? It's important to remember stuff like that. But they don't like to mention it now because the Japanese is our friends now, and they don't like to admit they're afraid they'll offend them. I don't mind offending them. They offended me when they killed my friend, and at that time. And I sat in my tank, a gunner, and there was a cave there, and I was going to close the cave, mouth of the cave. And there was, and I was shooting them down as they come out. Finally, they just quit coming by and trying to get back in. And there's a tank over 100 yards or so from me shooting the Japanese off of the top of our tank. It was trying to pry in to get into us. We didn't know nothing about that, but we did. We closed the cave.
Well, and that brings up something that, you know, is kind of legendary about Iwo Jima. Did you have any idea how many caves and tunnels they had there?
Oh, they were thick. They were thick, they said. They had years and years and years to fix that up, and they said they had tunnels running everywhere. So I don't really know.
I'm just wondering if you guys knew that in advance. Did you have any preparation for that, or was that kind of a surprise as the battle went along?
No, I don't know. I think... Oh, the intelligence probably knew all about that, but we never looked back.
When somebody says, once a Marine, always a Marine, what does that mean to you?
I guess that's what it means, but I don't think I think like a Marine, and I don't think I talk like a Marine, and I don't think I'm mean as a Marine. Well, I know I'm not mean. I'm a lover.
Maybe that's the answer to this next question, but, you know, not too many people make it to 100 years old. And here you are. What's your secret for living this long?
You know, what you do is you do the best you can and leave the rest to the Lord. He'll take care of you. And he's the one, you know, after all, he's the one that's got the final say. If he wants you to live 100, you will. And if he don't, you won't. So I had a friend. He's passed away a long, long time ago. And we was really good friends. And he told me one day, he said, you're going to probably live to be 100. You don't let nothing bother you. You just take it as it comes. And he was right. I just take things as they come. And here I am. He was right.
When you think back over 100 years, is there something you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Yeah, I married her. You know, you don't think I'm dumb, do you?
I hear you loud and clear.
I tell you, we got a good son.
Well, here's another question. So I asked you, looking back, what you're most proud of, but is there something you're still looking forward to, something you haven't done or something that hasn't happened in 100 years that you're kind of still hoping might?
No. I'm ready to go anytime. All right. But I don't want to leave her. She wouldn't know how to get along without me. She waits on me all the time. She's my caretaker. Well, after all, I tell her I'm 100.
You know, if there's anything I didn't ask you about that you think is important to share, please feel free. But I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that nobody else could. Is there anything else you think we ought to know?
I'm glad to be an American. I'm proud of that flag, yeah. And I'm proud of my wife, and I'm proud of my son.
You have any advice you want to share with the rest of us?
Get a good woman. The old song is, kiss an angel good morning. And then I always say, and treat her like a queen when you get home. But I say treat her like an angel when you get her back home. And that's what my wife is. She's a little angel.
Well, I don't think any more needs to be said, do you? Thanks to Jesse and Lola Arnie for letting us into their world today. If that explosion under his tank on Iwo Jima had done just a little more than knock him out and gash his chin, we never would have heard this story. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can see what Jesse looked like as a World War II Marine and see the smiles on the Arnie's faces after 75 years of marriage. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.